Woohoo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And I'm so excited to chat with you, David. I've been gone for 72 hours, and I feel like we could record a 6-hour podcast at this point.
Yeah, we've barely gotten a chance to talk. We've essentially just done the thing when couples come together where they gossip a little bit, and then we went straight to sleep because you didn't sleep much this weekend.
Actually, our gossip was primarily centered around your training. I was like, I want all the details. You had this big 3-day training block while I was gone, which in conjunction with solo parenting, I was like, how are you doing this right now? But you pulled it off, and I was like, I want all the details.
Big time players make big time plays, Megan. So 6 weeks out from the Grindstone 100K, and I did on Friday 32 miles with 6,300 feet of vert, then 20 miles on Magnolia Road, and then a big treadmill run yesterday, all while solo parenting. Are you proud of me? Because I'm pretty proud of me.
I'm like mind blown by you, actually. Like, proud doesn't even do it justice. I'm also like, how did this happen? This is a little strange. But when you say big treadmill workout, you did 9,000 feet of vert on the treadmill during nap time.
Yeah.
Extremely impressive.
Well, Leo, just such a badass boss baby. I told him, I was like, hey, man, I need some time to go on the treadmill.
I need dad time.
But then the thing is, like, after a while, I felt pretty bad at first. And I was like questioning how long I should go. And then I'm like, well, I need to go for as long as his nap is. And then he kept sleeping and kept sleeping. I'm like, motherfucker, you better wake up soon. Stop making me do this. This is like absolute hell on earth.
Well, you sent me a picture. We have this Nanit video camera to watch him in his crib. And the nap total, it was like, he's been sleeping for 3 hours and 24 minutes. I was like, holy shit, is he breathing? Is this okay?
Yeah, you actually did ask him if he was breathing. Spoiler alert, he was. But I was a little bit worried about that too. So I got off before he finished his nap. But it was a great training weekend. I ate a ton. I did my classic bachelor things where I essentially ordered burgers every day you were gone. Everything I ate this weekend had bacon on it, which I think is the ultimate key to performance.
It's the ultimate bachelor and actually bachelorette weekend, because I was doing the same thing on the other side. I went to a bachelorette party this weekend.
Yeah.
And bachelorette parties are like my ultimate. I am not skilled at all for bachelorette parties. I feel like everything that like exists in that bachelorette party Venn diagram, I'm like on the outside of. Like, don't include me in. But you know what? It was really fun.
You had fun.
It was amazing.
I was proud of you for going.
Actually, I was going to say the same thing. Like, it's a very strange statement to say I'm proud of myself for going to a bachelorette party, but it's the type of thing, like, I feel like between parenting and coaching and work and my own training, I would typically like skip it if it wasn't such a close friend. And it was such a fun weekend that I was like, you know, I'm actually really proud of myself for doing this.
I think for personalities like ours, staying at home, training a lot, and eating lots of bacon is the path of least resistance,
it's
right?
It's so true, yeah.
Like, maybe my Strava files look scary, but what's a lot scarier to me is being in a public place with people at any time. Like, that to me is my nightmare.
Being up to midnight, a lot scarier to me.
Oh my gosh.
But you know what? It was worth it. It was so fun. And I was like pleasantly surprised. And I was, as I was doing it, it's kind of like every once in a while when you get to like mile 26 of a 32 mile long run, you just got to pat yourself on the back and be like, I'm doing it. And I had that reflection on Saturday night. I was like, I'm doing it. And this is fun. I'm enjoying it. This is mile 26.
I did actually have a moment like that in the long run. So I was doing 5 mile loops or 5.5 mile loops, and each one had like 1,100 feet of vert. And I didn't realize it was going to be kind of warm that day because I was in a rush. I didn't even look at the weather forecast. And every single loop, it came by the Boulder Creek. So I would just like put a little bit of water on myself. But before the last loop, I was just kind of like hot and tired. And I go down to the creek and I just like lay down in it. And there's a woman there with her easel who's doing it like a painting. And I'm just like, oh man, this painting's going to be called like The Depths of Despair. And it's going to prominently feature me because she saw me on each loop.
She better draw you in. Like you go to those drawing classes and there's like naked people posing for photos. You could just like naked creek pose post long run.
Yeah. It reminds me of an old SNL skit with Will Ferrell where like he just goes up there with all of his chest hair and is like, draw me. That's exactly the vibes I felt like I was bringing.
Except with your full body shaved.
Yes.
Because we talked about this on the last podcast that you recently like shaved your full body and it made you feel so much faster. And it was for this painting, wasn't it?
Yeah, it worked out perfectly. In fact, we got a couple listener emails that were about they tried this. It shows how much influence we have. We are influencers.
It's a little scary, actually, because we talk about some things on here that are a little bit random and very, very weird.
Yes. So there's a lot of science. And I think sometimes the science juxtaposed with random shit makes the random shit feel like it's, more thought goes into it than it does. But both people said it didn't necessarily make them faster, but they did feel better, which was interesting. I realized one more pro tip that I wanted to give for all the listeners is, okay, that's step one. What's step two of really leveling up your body grooming for men? It's after you finish cutting your hair and all. You just have setting one on the little razor that you use. Just zoop right across the eyebrows.
Right across the eyebrows? I'd be so afraid that zoop would just like take them all out. There would be no eyebrows left in existence. But you know what? I would probably love you if you zooped and removed all your eyebrows. You'd probably look pretty ply.
Well,
you'd feel fast at least.
It's so true.
Maybe you'd be a lot faster.
Arrow face.
I have to be careful what I say because you do a lot in the name of speed. Yeah. I feel like you would totally shave your eyebrows if you're like 1% faster.
I need those face watts, Megan. When anything that makes prevents me from becoming my dad whose eyebrows go all the way to his ears. Like that would be my nightmare.
You could probably take a nose strip and bridge your two eyebrows. I wonder if that would make you faster.
Wait, how would that work?
Like put it across. It's like a unibrow with a nose strip.
Yeah. Interesting. And I guess it would just kind of hold things back. Airflow
exactly.
Will be really efficient.
Yeah.
So you had a great weekend at this bachelorette party. And you also did epic training there. I was so proud of you seeing your Stravas pop up. I'm like, damn, Megan, you're a straight adventurer.
Well, it was fun, but it was also for a reason. It's because I rented a gravel bike and it was so damn expensive.
Yeah.
And it was actually great because I probably wouldn't have trained as much if I did, if I hadn't rented this super expensive gravel bike. And I was like, I need to earn it. This thing was $160 for 2 days.
I think that's a reasonable price.
That seems astronomical.
So are we talking $80 per day or $160 per day?
Oh, $80 per day.
Oh, that's totally reasonable.
You think that's reasonable? I mean, it was a carbon, it was a Ventum gravel bike. It was super nice.
What are you living in the 1980s, Megan? We got inflation here.
Okay. It seemed so high, but it was fun because I was like, I need to grab all these vert coins. I got to get $160 worth of vert coins. But I woke up, it was like 6 a.m. on Sunday morning. I was very tired from the night before. It was actually kind of great because I was like, I invested in this. I got to get my ass out the door. And it made me think about like investing in things in general. And sometimes I feel like taking that leap and investing in something is actually the best thing for like your physiology, your career, various things, because you got to show up.
So your advice is to pay for something that makes you feel guilty.
No, I mean, there's like,
that's what coaching is actually.
Yes.
Everyone should get a coach because, hey, and you should get the most expensive coach you can. If your coach costs $600, you're going to go run because otherwise like you may, oh, I guess I'm just burning a hole in my pocket right now.
Well, as I was out there biking and I was like biking, I was gravel biking through like all these like fields of weeds. And I was like, I'm going to get a flat tire out here. I'm going to have to like get a double flat and Uber back home and things are going to get even more expensive. But I was thinking out there, I was like, okay, at some point, Megan, just accept the sunk cost.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't need to get hit by a car. It's okay to like accept the sunk cost of an investment a little bit.
Yeah. $160 over 2 days versus like $100,000 from that full body reconstruction surgery.
Yeah, exactly. So got to weigh the pros and cons a little bit, but it was actually really fun. There's something really freeing about exploring by bike.
Yeah.
I mean, running is way simpler. You don't have to shave your whole body. It takes like a lot less money and time and investment.
Yes. Just to be clear, you can shave your whole body when you're running. Continue.
Okay, but biking, you get so far.
Yeah.
I mean, I covered like 45 miles. We were in Park City. I ended up in many, many towns away. Got to see so much cool stuff. And it was actually this reflection of biking's pretty cool from like the journey that you get to be on. Running, still way cooler. But when you have to bike, it's actually great.
It's a really cool thing about athletics in general is getting to actually explore spaces. And it's something I always try to remember both as a coach and an athlete is the distance covered and how magical that can be. And I say this, meanwhile, in my actions, I'm just doing 5 mile loops over and over and over to get to 32 miles.
Well, there's something extra rewarding about loops. I mean, I could loop something on like 0.25 miles and do it over, I guess that's a track.
But yeah,
I could not loop a track 0.25 miles, but I could loop like
a wooded loop,
a grass field, loop, that sweet track on the Nike campus. I could do that over and over again for so many miles.
Yeah, you're a little bit of a deviant with that because I remember when we first met, you would sometimes do runs and you didn't have GPS back then, but knowing what I know now, you probably did essentially 70 minutes at 6 minute pace. And you would often do it just around the grass field. And occasionally you would change directions on the grass field. And I'm talking small fields. And I was like, okay, she's a little crazy, but I respect it.
Well, if we did local legends over time, like the 10-year local legends, I think I would still have those.
Yes.
Even though I haven't run there in many, many years. But I was thinking we should do that on Strava. Like, you know, the local legends kind of shift after 3 months. I think it's 90 days cap on the local legends.
Yeah.
What about all-time local legend? Wouldn't that be fun?
I mean, maybe. But I feel like it's good to turn it over.
Dude, you're skeptical. You uplift so many of my ideas. And for that one, you're like, nope.
Well, I feel like it's good to give people new goals to shoot for. That's the whole point of
local
legends.
But you should have both. So you have like the 90 days and then you should have all time.
So essentially what we're hearing now
is 2 leaderboards.
You want all of the CRs and all the local legends. You're like, bitches, This software needs to be designed to uplift me. This is my main goal.
Well, the software will, because you did not uplift that idea. We yes and on this podcast, and you're like, no, girl, that was shitty.
I no-butted that.
Yes.
Okay, so we have the best podcast for you today. We're going to be talking about starting with some coaching science and coaching thoughts that might get into anything you care about. Mental health study, building off that. A discussion of food doping. Very excited for that. Some sports stories. Two performance studies from cycling. And finally, hot takes.
Okay, I think this is the first time you've ever created a reasonable roadmap for this episode.
Yeah.
I think we're going to cover all of those.
I do.
You dream so big on our roadmaps. And I would say there's at least one or two things every single episode that don't happen. I think we can get through everything.
I think what happened here is because this weekend, you know, usually, let's be honest, you shoulder the burden of childcare. You're the best mom in the world, which leaves me for some time in the podcast outline. And so I just start adding things all week. Like our podcast outline before I organize it is like 47 things, none of which have to do with athletics. And it just says like tapas. And it was like, let's do a discussion of tapas and why tapas are shitty. And we don't usually get to that type of thing. This weekend, I was a little bit busier. And as a result, focused outline.
You are bachelor streamlined. Can I have a streamlined discussion with you real quick?
Okay.
Because you said something that I want to follow up on. Yeah. Why are tapas shitty?
Why are tapas shitty?
Yeah.
Okay. You just can't get enough food from tapas. And if you do get enough food, you're spending like $160 no matter where you do it. And granted, I understand this is like a cultural thing and I don't want to insult a whole thing of food that I know literally nothing about, but I've gone to one tapas restaurant in my entire life and I finished the tapas restaurant being like, okay, now let's go to an ice cream restaurant because it was not enough for me.
Okay, well, I'm going to know about you because I think tapas are amazing. You get to try so many different things.
Yeah.
At that tapas restaurant, we ordered ribs, which is not typically like a meal I would order, and they were delicious.
Yeah.
So I feel like you get to try so many different things. You can just order more tapas and then you can go to ice cream after. Like, yeah. That's a dream.
And what is an aid station but a tapas bar?
That's
really
so true.
When you think about it.
Yes.
It's like, I'll have some potato chips and some jelly beans and some Coke. It's perfect.
And some ribs.
Yeah. And I'll stick my hand in a thing of mashed potatoes that everyone else sticks their hand in too, which is a classic tapas restaurant activity.
It is a tapas experience, but you know what? Immunity.
Yes, this is true.
We're trying to build our like immune systems and Leo's immune system.
That's actually true about tapas restaurants too. There's a lot of commingling if you're doing it in a social manner.
Well, I was going to say it's a great date actually.
Yeah.
One of our first dates was at a tapas restaurant. Do you remember that?
Wait, really?
Yeah, in North Carolina.
Okay, no, I'm actually totally blanking.
Okay, you got so excited. This was back in the day when you were like heavily researching restaurants.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't go to like the world's shittiest hotel of all time.
I would take you to like a jazz bar or something.
Yes,
and
yeah.
I was like, ooh, this is really good. I like jazz now.
We were extremely cultural for the first 6 months of our relationship and that had a very fast linear decline.
Yes.
But we went to a tapas bar like 3 months, I had like third date into our relationship.
Do you remember any stories from it?
No, but it was delicious food.
Okay.
Remember, we had plantains. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do remember the plantains. All you need to do is mention plantains. Okay, I take it all back. Tapas are life.
It was also the last time that we had plantains.
Yeah. But we went out on top.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Okay. So we want to start with a little discussion of coaching because a study just came out in sports medicine that I think is like a game-changing study. It's really gained a lot of traction in this space. And I think 3 years from now, a lot of people will be talking about it. So I thought it was important because it also ties into how we think about performance and, you know, science more generally.
Well, I feel like it also links together a lot of the various things that we're going to talk about. And I love how you did that transition.
Yeah.
You literally went from plantains to coaching within a breath.
That's what I do, Megan.
It's excellent. He's like, you know what? Really no need for transitions. We're just going to do it.
You know how they say like there are two wolves inside of you? One of my wolves is plantains and one is coaching. Fried plantains and coaching.
Wolves inside of you? I've never heard that expression before.
No, you're not online enough.
No.
You ever heard the expression like he's got that dog in him?
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
I've got that plantain in me. Yeah. Okay, so on Patreon this past week for the Hazat here. I wrote an essay on coaching. I'm going to read a quick excerpt from that. As always, patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. At that there right now, through tomorrow, we are accepting gear orders. The gear is out. So make sure you register after you listen to this podcast, ideally by Wednesday. We're going to be ordering some extras, so there will be opportunities in the future, but get in on it now if you can.
And ideally order a crop top.
Yeah.
Because David and I had a bet on the number of crop tops we were going to sell because I believe so hard in the crop tops. And you should see the messages I got on Instagram. Everyone was like, that crop top is so dreamy. But we're a little short of
yes.
my bet.
And what Megan's saying is she's getting her ass kicked because not enough people have ordered crop tops.
We're close. We're towing that line.
We are not even close, Megan.
I know. We're getting there. So okay. I believe, please order a crop top. You'll support me in our husband-wife relationship.
I feel like enough people will just try to spite me that it might possibly work. Okay, so here's a couple paragraphs from it, then we'll get into the study. When an athlete trusts a coach, they're trusting them with their athletic plan. And as any lifelong athlete knows, an athletic plan forms the backbone of a day, a training cycle, a year, a life. We never saw coaching as just coaching or just numbers. Coaching was and is a relationship, inevitably one of the most important relationships in an athlete's life. So it better be one of the most important in our lives too. But all that touchy-feely process-oriented stuff is cool. But let's be real. Results still matter, especially for pros who put food on their table from the sport. No runner ever won a championship due to their personal empathy and kindness, though it would be a really cool sport if it worked that way. Still, I think the caring element of the equation is critical because of how it feeds back into a never-ending process of learning and relearning, together with athletes, refining training theory as it applies on an individual level based on genetics and background.
That's so beautiful. Also, this is a window into my world in which I love when you write because you get so excited to read me stuff that you've just written. So you'll be sitting there on the couch and you'll emerge from your writing space and say, hey, Megan, listen to these two paragraphs. And so you read these to me last week. I was like, David, this is brilliant. That's a really beautiful writing.
But I mean, I think the place here that's really relevant for me, at least in thinking about this, is that for a coach often, and for anyone that works in this type of thing, like a therapist, let's say, your relationship with someone is by definition misbalanced. Because like in a therapy relationship, let's say, whoever your therapist is one of the most important people in your life. But a therapist might have a number of different people that they all care about deeply. But if you lose sight of that relationship as, you know, coach, as a teacher, as anything like this, you're going to be letting people down so much. So what I always try to remind myself is, you know, this line in there that like, you know, when an athlete trusts a coach, they're trusting them with an athletic plan. And as any lifelong athlete knows, an athletic plan forms the backbone of a day, a training cycle, a year, a life. So like your role in someone's life is so important. And then that must go beyond athletics, which kind of brings us to the study that we're going to talk about today.
Well, I think that's such an important point because it's like, when I communicate with athletes, I think I recognize that, but I also try not to be so cognizant of it that it gives me like a coach. I can't move forward as a coach because yes, like what we're giving to athletes is super important in the context of their lives. Especially when I ask athletes like you, like go run 32 miles. It's like, that's the huge backbone of a day, a weekend, a bachelor weekend, like a dad context. And so I feel like as a coach, it's important to be cognizant of that, but also not let it like give you the inability to give hard training.
If every time you open an athlete's log, you get the nervous poops,
there's
a problem. And I totally agree. This weekend in particular, so we were 3 weeks before the UTMB races. So a lot of our athletes are doing kind of insane training. Like we talked about that a little bit last week. I was so worried all week. And it is kind of important to take a step remove, but at the same time, invest yourself fully because an athlete's entire nature goes into not just their performance, but also their happiness. So the study was just came out in Sports Medicine and it's called Coaches' Perceptions of Factors Driving Training Adaptation, an international survey.
I like this study a lot. I feel like so rarely we see like the intersection of coaching practices in exercise physiology studies. And to me, that's confusing because I feel like coaching is at the heart of exercise physiology. So why aren't we looking at the two of those and how they relate to performance more often?
And I think that that's the coolest part about the study is it points out a major offset here that might mean that almost every study we talk about has some flaws just in the basic way that science can be constructed. So this study in particular has some incredible authors, including, I think, John Keeley? Kylie?
We were just debating how to pronounce this last name. We need like one of those. It's so fun to go into Google and it's just like, you enter Word. I entered Verdant in earlier and it was like, Verdant.
Oh.
And we need that for authors' last names of studies.
Why'd you write in Verdant?
You'll see, it's coming ahead.
Oh, it's coming ahead.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy. Yeah. This is exciting.
Well, we don't plan the podcast that often, but every once in a while, I'm like, I need to know how to pronounce a word.
Yeah.
Which is not often enough. But every once in a while, I do.
I did plan a couple bits while you were gone, but I haven't gotten to them. I don't think I'm going to.
What are the bits on?
Well, I had a whole one on masculinity.
Oh.
In my reflections of getting to spend time with, you know, little boy that's growing, and as a man, and what masculinity is, and how I think we should really think about it differently.
Well, can we talk about that? Maybe not now, because we're in the middle of a coaching discussion, but I would love to hear about that.
We'll see. We'll see at the end we get to it. Maybe it'll be a hot take.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is kind of a hot take.
Okay, I'm going to call you on that.
Awesome. So the way that this study worked is it took 106 coaches, and 31% of them had 15 plus years of experience. 32% were doing this on the international level. And then Megan, I noticed, put in this line. They were predominantly male.
92%. That's huge. Yeah. We need more women coaches.
Yeah. Maybe that's a flaw in the study design. I don't know.
Well, I also think we need more women coaches. So this study had a lot of coaches at the international level. We need more women coaches coaching athletes at the international level.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you're a women coach, like, don't be afraid to take on higher level athletes. I mean, like, you know, work within how you feel comfortable over time, but like push yourself a little bit out of your comfort zone in terms of that. Because so often I feel like women feel like they're stuck coaching beginner athletes. And it's like, no, like, I think there's gender roles in society that women feel that way more often than men. Definitely. But I think take on higher level athletes progressively and see what happens.
Yeah. That coaching essay actually might be helpful. Maybe I'll open it up to everybody, because that whole idea is trying to tell everyone, the last line of it is, you are born for coaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And overcoming the imposter syndrome of that type of feeling might be a little bit gendered in society and just how society approaches things. So that is important. And then I think the big money finding here is, in the survey, the top five factors in modifying an athlete's ability to physically adapt to a training plan were, and this is what the coaches rated, first, coach-athlete relationship.
Which 56% of the coaches said that was important.
It's kind of funny because like coaches are like, I am the most important one.
Yes, yeah.
And then two, life stress, that was 41%. Athlete's belief in the plan, 37%. Psychological and emotional stress, 35%. And then finally, physical training, which is like classic training theory, at 33%, which, you know, to the authors was like surprising. They were not expecting that type of finding.
And I think what I found most interesting was actually they had this great figure laying out some of the results of the survey. And one of the questions they ask is physical training, which goes into like all the physical things that athletes do.
Miles,
like,
strides, whatever.
Everything that goes into the training plan. Is that the most important factor in determining sport performance and outcome? And only 2% of coaches said they strongly agreed with that.
Wow.
And many coaches said that they were either neutral or strongly disagreed. And I think it's really interesting that there's so many different things that go into the athlete's training plan. And coaches think that the actual structure of the training plays a lot less of a role than we would intuitively think.
And that's especially relevant based on how every amount of science is structured.
Yes.
Yeah. Where there's no point when you're looking at data that like we present on the podcast where you're like, but is that data point happy? Like, how's their marriage? How is their mental health in general? So like all of these things go in together. And so here's a quote from the study that is really relevant here. Importantly, none of the non-physical factors highlighted are typically documented in training and/or periodization studies. In fact, within the training-specific literature, it is difficult to find a study that documents or even acknowledges the potential role of non-physical influences in the context of training adaptation. If future training research does not take note of these factors' role, then the field remains vulnerable to becoming increasingly detached from the coaching community.
That's such a strong sentence. What do you think plays some of the biggest roles? So they're talking about non-physical influences.
Yeah.
And they have kind of this host of stuff written out in the paper. What are the biggest non-physical influences that you see in an athlete's training?
I mean, I think just mental health and stress
are
the big ones. You know, and I think the complicated thing here is it's all kind of...
all related.
It's an all amalgamation of similar variables.
I was going to say, if we were to look at all of these variables, there'd be like a huge correlation with variables with each of the others.
Yeah. Like, an athlete has trouble believing if they're also just depressed and have trouble believing in anything, you know? And similarly, like when we say believe in all caps, the reason that we emphasize it over and over and over again is because hopefully you can nudge your baseline a little bit, but it's hard to just totally change who you are, right? Like, I think I'm born as a believer. Like, that's why I'm a great coach. And I think every coach has to be a believer.
But you have to have huge amounts of trust to be a believer.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, I'm also very willing to trust. I'm willing to jump in with both feet.
Yes.
And that's probably tied more to my mental health context than anything, like brain chemistry and things. And
do you think do you think you're very willing to trust? I would say you actually have a healthy level of skepticism. And then once you reach that hurdle, you are all in. But I do think your barrier to trust, as it should be, like, I mean, I think if you were just like putting 2 feet into everything, it would be very challenging. But I do think your barrier to trust is high, which is, I think, actually a good thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, as a result, I don't get caught by email scams.
Yes.
So, like, that's a good thing. Like, I'm good in that regard. But what I mean is, when I decide that I'm invested in someone, I'm all in.
Yes. Yeah. To the point where if they texted us and they were like, I murdered so-and-so, we'd be like, we got your back.
Yeah. Yeah. I got some shovels. And honestly, they deserved it. Did you see their Twitter? Actually, you know what they did, Megan,
what?
To deserve getting murdered? They just leave their Stravas as morning run.
Oh my gosh, that's the worst.
They don't update their titles.
Yes.
It's like, what more? I mean, maybe not murder, but you should at least get like imprisoned. It actually is a really big pet peeve of me. And it's like, come on, this is social. Like, at a certain level, if I see your morning run, I'm like, this isn't, you could just use your GPS function for that.
Okay. Anyone with a morning run should not be documented on the local legends leaderboard.
Okay. This is a good hot take. I think we're kind of bringing some hot takes here. Do you think we lost some friends for our morning run take?
I don't know. I mean, there's not... What percentage of people do you think do morning runs on Strava?
I think that's a lot.
Is it a lot?
I think it's really a lot.
Okay. Well, you can at least use AI to generate a title.
Okay. Yeah, that's actually true. That would be a good thing. So, you know, we talk about AI a lot on the podcast. That is the best use of it right there.
You can give instructions too.
Yeah.
You can say a playful title, a David Roach title. I wonder if we fed your Strava like titles into AI, it could come up with some pretty good ones.
Yeah. It would be a mix of like total random jokes, song titles, and then like absolutely over the top earnestness.
Is that right? It's a good combo. I like it.
Okay. So back to the study. What do you think are the variables that are most important outside of physical training for athletes?
I would agree 100%. I think mental health, stress. I love the element of belief, yeah. Like an athlete's belief in the coach and the training process. And I think that is so heavily correlated with mental health to the point that if I think that an athlete is not believing in the training process,
yeah,
I will call it out. I'll just say like, hey, we need to have a discussion about this or talk about it. But I often are like, we should have you talk with a mental health counselor, yeah, therapist, because I feel like there's so much there at the roots that digging through all that's really important.
That's so hard to actually call it out though, because like sometimes if I ever decide that I might see this in someone that they're not believing and that's a problem, like yeah, even if it's not believing in me,
yeah,
I'm like, well, I feel bad about doing it because then I'm like, I'm saying you should believe in me. And then that's like ego driven in some ways. Do you ever struggle with that?
No, I don't think it's ego driven because I think it's believing in the relationship and the broader process, which has nothing to do with me or the training. Like they need to believe in a training system, yeah, whether it's my training system or someone else's. And so I think maybe calling out, I think sometimes has negative connotations as a word phrase,
yeah,
but it's more like I have a conversation with them about it. I'm like, whatever training you're doing, whether it's mine or someone else's, like, or your own, you just have to believe in it. Definitely, and believe, yeah, that it's going to work.
Yeah. And so, you know, this study is fascinating in just individual response generally. And the authors make a point there to say, when you look at these studies, they never really point out anything about the individual data points. And the variables that go into that are so much more important sometimes than baseline VO2 max or muscle fiber composition or anything like that. So understanding individual responses, how they vary, and how that relates to mental health, I mm-hmm. think every coach sees. But we really need to start understanding as it relates to training science and, you know, how these processes unfold long term. You can even see it in like training volume and stuff. Like when athletes are fucking killed by their coach,
yeah,
in short term, even if it works, often that leads to really negative places, and probably because it starts to interact not just with the physiology of it, like they lose their speed, but then also some of the like softer quote parts of being an athlete, of like mental health and whether you love the process and whether you just burn out.
And I feel like so often these variables get labeled as confounding variables across,
yeah,
studies,
yeah, exactly,
and you have to control for them. But I think the whole point of this paper is, no, we shouldn't just control for them. We should actually study for them.
Yeah.
We should actually study them and look at them. And yes, there's studies that look at, and we're actually just about to talk about a study that looks like mental health in ultramarathon runners, but I feel like it's so rarely directly tied to performance,
yeah,
in coaching and some of these other variables that we need more of like the connective tissue that weaves together all these different things.
Yeah. Happiness is not a confounding variable.
Happiness is not just connective tissue.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and that should be our goal.
Yeah.
Even as we're talking, and the reason we talk about performance so much is because like the seeking that out is so fun and like the process of that. But remember, it all comes down to happiness, which brings us to the study that Megan just teed up, which just came out on mental health in ultra running. We thought this was a good segue here. I think it was also in sports medicine. Not sure exactly, but it was a meta-analysis that looked at 11 different studies. And it found that between 32% and 62.5% of athletes said they had eating disorders. From 11.5 to 18.2% had exercise addiction, 18.6% for depressive symptoms, and 24.5% for sleep disturbance.
And those are really high prevalence numbers. And I don't, yeah, think it's entirely surprising. I think based off of athletes that we coach and interactions that we've had in the ultra running world,
yeah,
like I'm not surprised, but we're also human too. So these stats they're definitely higher than population level norms. But I wouldn't say they're that much higher too. And we're also, yeah, I mean, I feel like as ultra runners, we're all human, but I do think it's interesting to dive in. So you said between 32% and 62.5% for eating disorders.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I was like, geez, 62.5% for eating disorders,
yeah,
is very high.
That is very high.
But as I dove into that number, I was like, oh, 62.5% is familiar.
Yeah.
And I realized that it came from a study that we did at Stanford,
yeah,
at Western States, and they actually misinterpreted it.
Oh gosh.
So we said 62.5% yeah, of female runners were at some level of risk for disordered eating.
And like a risk, there's like a cumulative risk assessment, right? If I
so
remember
we
your
used
presentation.
The EDEQ, which is the Eating Disorders Examination Questionnaire. And that was diagnosing like risk for disordered eating. It wasn't diagnosing eating disorders.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting how they interpreted this. So I actually think it's lower than that number. I was doing an investigative deep dive and I was like, ooh, I don't know. I don't know about that.
That's so interesting. Like to actually be reading a study and be like, oh man, maybe they didn't read this quite the right way.
Well, it's hard because I feel like that number is going to get populated a lot. Yeah. I think we will probably let them know in a nice way.
Yeah, it is kind of like a sexy number because it seems so high.
It's so high.
Like people are going to grasp onto it for like news outlets.
And it is still so high. So if 63% of women are at risk for disordered eating, that's super duper high. But there is a bigger difference between disordered eating and eating disorders.
And at risk is a totally different thing than have.
Yes, like, exactly.
As you think about this.
Yeah, our study didn't have the ability to diagnose eating disorders.
Yeah, but no matter what, like, these numbers are quite high, and it comes down to like athletics. I mean, a lot of why people come to athletics can vary a lot, and it can issues can predate this, or athletics can be, you know, a difficult process for people as they grow. Because like, you know, I think, and that being said though, I think it just comes down to like being human. Like you said, a lot of this stuff is really hard and it all interacts then with training. And so what are we supposed to do?
And it all interacts with each other too. Yeah. So I feel like a lot of these different things are correlated with each other. I love that they talked about exercise addiction, up to 18% of ultra running athletes experiencing exercise addiction. And that's high.
Yeah.
And exercise addiction highly related to eating disorders. So I saw a separate study that said 39 to 48% of people with eating disorders suffer from exercise addiction, which is that's a high, high number.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really high. And I guess my question would be, I don't really know like the etiology, like the, what exercise addiction truly means in the psychology literature.
Well, they have criteria for diagnoses, but they're all subjective. It's like, how does a person feel about exercise? Some of it's subjective, like what are their certain behaviors that they're doing? But a lot of it is, I think there's a broad spectrum of exercise addiction.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like any of these behaviors, like some people might be on the left of that and other people on the right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, whenever I think about addiction in general, as I understand it, it's quite complicated.
Oh, it's very complicated.
In terms of how the brain works. Because like for me, like athletically, I want to do it and it's a non-negotiable part of my day.
Yes.
I would be fine without it, I think.
No, I don't think you have exercise. I don't think either of us have exercise addiction because I think like there's a level of inflexibility and like reliance on the endorphins associated with exercise that I don't think, I think if you take rest days very easily.
Yeah.
If you had to rest for 5 days, you'd be like, okay, this is my new existence. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but it's just interesting to think about like how we classify this stuff in general, because like, and especially with addictions of things like exercise or, you know, sex or things that aren't like substance abuse issues. As I understand it, it's a little complicated. So, I mean, I don't know, like, I think as athletes, you know, perceive this stuff, that's one place where rest days are really important, is because it's a dopamine reset and it kind of makes sure you stay off this track, as I understand it. Like, if you don't take a rest day, you absolutely should. Like, one rest day every 7 to 10 days. Like, if you don't do that, I think often athletes do find themselves going down these paths without realizing it. Kind of like how one drink ends up becoming alcoholism over like a really long-term cycle.
Yeah, just like that slow slip into it. I feel like an athlete's willingness to take rest days is a big, we could almost use that as like a grading scale for exercise addiction.
Interesting, yeah.
Whereas athletes like, and I think also too, there's a level of like, I have to do this exercise. Like the AQI is 250 outside and I'm going to go do a 20-mile long run, even though that's not good for the body. And I feel like that's for me as a coach where I start to draw that line is when athletes are doing things that are undercutting performance.
Yeah.
And I feel like I see that not that uncommonly as a coach.
Definitely.
And it's really hard because I think people with exercise addiction often perform really well to some extent until the,
especially short term.
Yeah. And it's kind of challenging to ask those questions and to understand more and to dig into it.
And it's also hard because, you know, we were joking about Strava earlier, but then there's the social pressures of seeing what other people are doing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And like imagine it's essentially like being an alcoholic and you're going to the bar all the time.
And you're like, I'm the local legend of this bar. I had 45 drinks. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But then the 45 drinks are celebrated.
Yes, exactly.
In your head and it can make you feel inadequate. So, you know, to zoom out from all of these studies, I think essentially let's prioritize mental health and thinking about this. Like you are not numbers at all in your training, and you are not, you know, the mistakes you make. You're not any of these things. You are just a single data point. And what we care about most is your happiness, your long-term health. Make sure you uplift that in the process. And I think that exercise science is going to start coming around to that too, because those are the athletes that will also adapt the longest term you know, while they're also being fulfilled.
I love that point. And I think we so often we refer to therapists and mental health counselors that on here, it's almost like a broken record. It's like, see one of those, but it's not always accessible. We were just talking about exercise addiction. Yeah. So how, as a coach, if you saw an athlete struggling that, would you address that or start that conversation? Especially if like perhaps some of those tendencies make them a champion.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's one place where our rest days come in handy, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think the problem for me becomes like, I know that if an athlete's doing the plan, to a certain extent, if there are tendencies towards this, they're going to be okay.
Yes.
Because we're constantly checking in and, you know, it'll come out. I think the problem becomes what happens when people are lying about what they're doing or not telling the the full truth, omitting.
How often do you think that happens? Have you seen that before?
I mean, how often has it happened and I had no idea?
Yeah, probably true.
What do you think? I mean, to me, my point being, I try to constantly talk about this, that like stress without rest is just self-destruction.
Exactly.
And that is so key to understand that like there's a thin line between something that builds you up and something that breaks you down. And if you're breaking yourself down without then stepping back for adaptation, it becomes like a masochistic like view of your body, which is so negative. Like, so I'd rather an athlete never run again in their entire life than break themselves down, you know, through these processes. Like, and I hope that that type of vibe that like, I care about your happiness and building you up is at the forefront of everything. Because like at the end of the day, who gives a shit who wins UTMB? Like that's not going to, you know, make or break a life. What makes or breaks a life is someone's ability to look in the mirror and be like, I like me.
Yeah. Well, I love that you brought up the masochistic point. Cause I feel like for me, there's these buckets. There's like, I'm doing things for performance. I'm doing things for joy.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes I feel like in the exercise addiction group, there's like, I'm doing things because I have to
compulsion,
do it.
Yeah.
Like this has to happen. And the challenge is sometimes I feel like those things overlap where like, there's a level of joy and there's a level of doing this for performance. And it becomes so hard.
And Friday for me.
To untangle.
I wouldn't have run 32 miles unless there was a bit of like forcing myself to do it. Like it did not flow easily.
Yeah. Today. You can never, I mean, I feel like if you trained fully on joy, you would never train to your potential because sometimes you just got to get out the door. For me, like at a bachelorette party, I'm getting out at 7 a.m. after a really late night. And some of that is performance. And a teensy bit of that is probably a layer of compulsion that we've both like harnessed to be good over time. But I'm just really curious about how all of those intersect.
Yeah, it's definitely not good or bad. There's a lot of gray.
Oh, there's so much grayscale. Yeah.
That's where I think it really comes in handy to constantly check in, but also do these resets, right?
Like, dopamine resets.
Dopamine resets all the time because you know, that gives you the understanding that not only psychologically are you able to do that, but then physiologically you're like in a much better place to take whatever stress you get thrown.
I love that. And I feel like we need an activity for rest on Strava so more people would do it.
Be
like,
yeah.
Morning rest. Yes, I'm doing it. Would you approve that if someone had morning rest on there?
Actually, that would be really, I think I would approve that because then that like, you're not like, I don't know, you're building into the vibes within the community that rest is cool.
Yes, I like it.
Rest is so fucking cool.
It is cool. And I actually enjoy it. Like we rest now on Mondays to record our podcast and I've come to love Mondays. By the end of the day, I'm like, oh, tomorrow will be great to run or bike or whatever it is I'm doing. But I look forward to these days.
Rest is so cool.
Yeah.
That should be one of, when we start breaking out the gear into more like merch, like things like podcast things, rest is cool needs to just be the first one.
Okay. It's kind of we need to up that. I feel like, so we often come up with like weird words. We need to have like restnanimous or something, something like that's much cooler. Rest is cool is slightly lame.
Okay.
We could do a better phrase.
All right. We'll think on that. And as we do, we want to do a quick promo that is incredibly important here for Athletic Greens, because this is the first time ever offer for 10 free travel packs if you use our code. So drinkag1.com/swap, SWAP. I think this is like a really special code that is only going out to a few different places. I'm not sure if that's true. If you start to hear it every single podcast you listen to, don't disregard. I feel like a really special boy though.
It's probably us and Huberman.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And I think that's kind of what they implied. So,
and every other podcast around the earth, just kidding.
But 10 travel packs, $30 value. This is one of the biggest offers they've done. And you also get free vitamin D. So as always, we swear by Athletic Greens. I'm going to take it as soon as I'm done the podcast. I actually forgot to take it before, which breaks my heart a little bit.
Oh my gosh. I did too.
Yeah.
And we're not wearing nose strips. What are we doing? We're missing like half our bit.
It's okay, Megan. We're enough as we are always.
We're Knuff.
I believe.
How do you pronounce that? Have you seen like the Barbie stuff?
Yeah.
Yes. Actually. Okay. Can we talk about your Strava for a second?
Yeah.
Because you had the Ken from Succession and the Barbie combined into one. And it was
Kendall from Succession.
Yeah. It was great. Yeah.
I did say he was Knuff. or Kenuff. But yeah, that was a pretty good Strava.
It was great.
Some of my Strava titles are pretty good. I got to give myself a big pat on the back. And you know what that might come from? Athletic Greens, because it gives me really strong brain waves. But as we talked about before, tons of micronutrients. It's essentially a multivitamin that can level up your adaptation and recovery with all the micronutrients in it. So drinkag1.com/swap. That special offer, I believe, is just going to last for 4 weeks. So if you get in now, get a lot of extra bonuses.
We are believers.
Yes.
We have Athletic Greens has cleared that high hurdle, and we are like 2 feet, all nostrils, all orifices, both butt cheeks in. Yes.
Both butt cheeks.
There's very few things that I put both butt cheeks in.
Yeah.
And it's like our relationship, Athletic Greens, and training.
Well,
and Leo, obviously.
I put 3 butt cheeks in.
Yeah.
Which is like, just think about that. That's commitment.
Do you have a third? Do you have a vestigial butt cheek?
Man. How have you not noticed this? Of course I do. Okay, on to the most important conversation, I think, that we do on here, because it can make a real difference. And this is on food doping. What a cool term that is. We teed it up at the end of last week's episode.
Yeah, doping on pasta. It's like my dream.
Yeah, and we're going to get into why we think this is relevant. But first, an email from a listener that came from Patreon. Just a quick note to say, heck yes, extreme fueling. I'm usually non-functional for many days after races. Stairs, that's cute. Please direct me to the wheelchair ramp so I can inch up it backwards. Your toilet doesn't have a handicap bar? I guess I'm doing a Megan-style side pee. Well, Saturday/Sunday, I raced an overnight race with a decent amount of vert. Inspired by you guys, and after a lot of practice in my long runs, I managed to take in 300 plus calories per hour during the race with next to no GI discomfort. Not only did I come in with a top position, I am shocked and extremely confused and also delighted to report that today I feel fine, like barely even sore, like energized and ready to spring out the door. Does this count as, and then this is the term that they termed, food doping? This is my new secret weapon. Let's try to keep it between us for now, okay?
Did you,
thank you,
ask their permission to share this term? Because I love that. Let's try to keep it between us. And then we're like, we're going to roll this out to all our podcast listeners.
Yeah,
and put it on a t-shirt.
Yeah, dude, yes. Yes, please. Food doping.
And can we, what would we put as the picture of food beneath it?
Pancakes with butter dripping off the side.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking a big pasta thing.
Pasta's good, but
tapas?
Like...
Plantains.
That's the thing. Tapas actually be perfect because then we get multiple different types of
foods.
Oh,
that'd be so fun. Yeah. Yeah, we could just have like 20 different orders of tapas.
It'd be so good.
Yeah.
No, they wanted this to come out to the world. They actually said on, tagged us on social media and said, because we teed their term up last week and said how excited they were to hear it. So I love this term, food doping, because as we've talked about before, I think, and I think we think, that this has fundamentally changed sports at the top level, and so much of the performance levels you're seeing now are because of this. And why I think food doping is a great term for it is many of the best performances in the world happened in the early 2000s, which is now known as the EPO era. So this is a time when they didn't have a reliable test for EPO. So athletes were just doing this willy-nilly, and you know, the top end of endurance sports across the world just reached an insane level. Now, many years later, the top level is getting back to those points across all endurance sports when I think testing is really good. And the main thing that has changed, aside from some things about training theory, are like people are eating a fuck ton during activity, especially endurance activity. So that's where food doping comes in. We're getting EPO through a mouth, which through like delightful carbohydrates and fat and protein.
Well, as you described 2000s as like the EPO era, yeah. I was thinking about now we're in the tapas era.
Yeah.
We're getting that food and we're getting it through all these different carbohydrate sources, AKA tapas.
Yeah.
It's great. But I'm actually curious about this because as humans, our physiology has not changed at all.
Yeah.
How did it take us this long to figure this out? Like this is the hot stuff. Like I feel like so many different studies are coming out about, you know, more extreme fueling approaches, 90 grams of carbs per hour, up to 120.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Like we as humans haven't changed. Why did it take us this long?
That is actually a fascinating question that I hadn't really thought of. So in reading Tyler Hamilton's book, speaking of doping, so a cyclist that doped a lot, he thinks that one of the reasons that they underperformed is they would almost never take in more than 60 grams of carbs per hour back then.
Yeah. Why do you, I mean, it just seems like they weren't aware of it. Were they afraid of like body composition stuff? So I'm confused.
I think it's where performance size can get a little bit difficult because there are some studies. So in the old days, especially, all the studies were on male athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you limit carbohydrate intake, you can see changes in markers of fat oxidation and some like protein synthesis, like adaptation types things. And I think sometimes that type of finding obscured the actual, like, what happens when you keep the fire burning really hot always, mm-hmm. and does that smooth everything out, especially for athletes that are already developed in those areas, and then especially for female athletes. And so, I mean, I think you can see it a lot, actually, in the discussions of low carb, high fat, which happened like 10 years ago.
I was just going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
Is this a backlash? It's like, I feel like so often in nutrition science, we have one approach that comes out, and then like 5 years later, it's like a political system. We're polarizing the other opposite direction.
Yeah.
And I wonder if some of this is like an accidental backlash to low carb, high fat.
Yeah.
And it's like the backlash to the backlash to the thing that's just begun, Bo Burnham style.
Yeah.
Like, where are we going with this?
I like the political like reference there. That's very interesting. And, you know, I think low carb, high fat has been proven totally wrong, though it does.
Well, it is also like a political system.
Yeah.
As we talk about belief it, people system. Are probably like, this is my belief system. This is what I believe in. But I almost feel like what we're doing now is a reaction to that, and a reaction to seeing how poorly some female athletes responded to it.
Yeah. And I think that that might have laid the groundwork for the studies and the science and the experimentation that ended up happening. And so a lot of this experimentation didn't start with the studies. Usually, like always, exercise science is usually coming from practice, and it kind of like feeds back. And so where this really began, as I understand it, is in the cycling peloton, that people that researched the physiology of it started having very, very, very high intakes, to the point that now sometimes athletes will take in 550 to 600 calories per hour in very long, intense races. Think about that. 600 calories per hour during activity. That is wild and bonkers. But what did they see? A wild thing. The performance at the end of races, measured via fatigue resistance, so how well people performed under a certain amount of load, improved massively. And so that was a huge signal, probably, that started, you know, emanating throughout the peloton. This is something that we need to pay attention to. We need to start increasing fueling intake. And then it kind of ripple effects all out through the world, because physiologists are, you know, intertwined with those teams.
What's curious to me, though, is when you say 600 calories per hour, it actually doesn't seem that daunting to me. But I feel like right alongside this movement to get in higher caloric totals per hour, we've also bettered our fueling sources too.
That's true.
Because it's the point where, okay, I could just slurp that. Like every time I take a big ass gel, I'm like, slurp.
Yeah.
And I could very easily take in 600 calories of just slurping shit.
Slurp.
Slurp. We're going to slurp some tapas.
Okay. That's what I think we should end the podcast with. I'm going to like cut out your little slurp there and then also put it at the end of the podcast. So you're just going slurp, slurp, slurp.
Are you
going
to rap it?
I'm going to have you rap.
I'm going to be like Meg the Stallion, but slurping.
I think Meg would be pretty proud of us.
Yeah. Well, Stallion's got to slurp.
Stallion's got to slurp. And you know, the interesting thing, I do think, like when you think about the products that are available, is that probably plays a role too. But even short of that, you know, athletes are starting to understand how their bodies respond. And basically, all of this leads to lower muscle damage, which doesn't just lead to better performance on the day. It also leads to higher adaptation rates. And that's where the food doping term comes in. You're not just getting better on that day. You're also improving how you adapt. So let's zoom out to my performance this weekend. On Friday, I didn't feel great, but I did a pretty good rate run. And I averaged about 450 calories per hour. I woke up on Saturday. I felt like $1 million. I felt better than I felt on Friday morning. And as a fast twitch boy like myself, like that's unexpected. And I purely tie it back to how I feel during the activity. That's why I did short loops, so I could feel so well without having to think about it. And this is then backed up by studies. So there's a 2021 study in Frontiers of Physiology that essentially found that athletes that increased their ultra-endurance athletes that increased their fueling up to 90 plus grams of carbs per hour decreased their muscle damage an insane amount. Like we're starting to see signals in physiology that essentially change how the body works on a cellular level. It is truly bonkers.
And there was a 2021 study that came out and that was finding that ultra runners were far too low.
Yeah.
And there's so much room for ultra runners to grow. And I feel like that's a big part of why we're seeing these performances like Tom Evans at Western States. He was taking in, what was he taking 120 grams of carbs per hour?
In the high country.
Yeah.
I think even up to 130 at times.
Yeah. That's wild. And so we're seeing these big changes. But what they found was that athletes that were racing at the 24-hour distance, which is a long time on feet, they were pretty suboptimal. They were only in like the 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrates per hour. And they weren't taking in multiple transportable carbohydrates either. And I feel like this is a big part. We're in the tapas era. Yeah. It's why we're seeing athletes level up in the ultra distance, is because we were just fueling far too low before.
Yeah. And there's a lot of studies like this. And the wild thing is what they find is if they do no intervention, so they just sit there and monitor what people do at these races, you can group athletes into cohorts, usually say, this athlete was under 30 grams per hour. This athlete was 30 to 60. This athlete was 60 to 90. And you see progressively better performance. So obviously subject to confounders about like how people relate with food generally. And
I was going to say that probably relates to mental health, which relates to performance outcomes. And it's fascinating. Like I imagine athletes that are willing to take in 90 to 120 grams per hour, one, have a level of swag that I really respect. But there's also probably some mental health with like changes with the ability to actually take those in.
Yeah.
And how does that relate to performance aside from the fact that they're taking in higher levels of carbohydrates?
Yeah. And it feeds back the other way too, that if you take in that much, and you're in a better mental context and athletics breaks you down less.
So oh, true.
You're able to be happier.
Your brain's got that glucose vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think I was able to do an outline even though I was parenting solo and doing big training?
Actually, the brain uses so much energy.
Yeah.
That actually is a really important point. And what I'm curious about, and we're just starting to do more research on this, is the relationships between mental health challenges and REDS.
Yeah.
And there's a bidirectional arrow there, but I do think a lot of like not having enough substrate for the brain is a big part of why mental health challenges exist. And of course, it's bidirectional.
Yeah.
But that substrate is a component.
Definitely. And so overarching recommendation is keep it simple. Like you can dig into the weeds of this stuff, but aim for 300 calories per hour during your longer runs. Just remember that number. Usually it means that you're taking in liquid calories and then you're taking in gels or real food or whatever you want every 20 to 30 minutes and just keep it coming. Like that is all you have to do. And then later on, you can start to play around at the margins of human performance. And if you keep it that simple, the cool thing is eventually you start to realize that what you thought were your endurance limits are often just limitations of fueling. And once you have that understanding, it's when crazy shit becomes popular or, possible. Like I'm not scared anymore of long distances, even with my muscle fiber typology and my background and stuff that isn't necessarily conducive to ultras, because I know at the end of the day, and I said this on our Patreon podcast last week that we recorded before my long run, I know that if I fuel well, at the end of the run, I'll be okay. I will not blow up. I will be able to keep moving.
You will not be a carcass in the creek for that lady to draw on her painting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was able to get back out of that creek and I fucking crushed it. And it was all because of slurps.
Yeah.
Slurps make champions, Megan.
You had a case of the slurps.
Yeah. Okay. So one more email from a listener that I think is relevant here to talk about how this works in practice. Hi, Megan and David. I just became a Patreon member a couple of weeks ago and have been loving your newsletters and bonus podcasts. Remember, you get that at Patreon. Thank you for the wonderful work that you do, spreading positivity and data-backed training strategies. I have noticed on your regular pod, you have mentioned food doping a few times and have talked about the strides made at the Tour de France with fueling. Can you speak more specifically about this? As someone with a sensitive stomach who has never had serious energy issues when taking in about 100 calories per hour, 30-ish grams of carbs per hour, how should I go about getting on the food doping train without upsetting my stomach?
Let's bump this person up to the better cohort.
Yes.
As you were talking about in the study, having different cohorts of fueling and carbohydrates, we need to like name them according to food sources.
Oh, I like it.
This would be like the kale cohort.
Yeah.
We need to get them in like the pasta and tapas cohort.
Yeah, the rice cake cohort is not crushing
the cardboard cohort.
Yeah, because I feel like we need to name it some sort of carb source.
Oh, good.
Like,
yeah, true.
Yeah, rice cakes. What else we got? Honestly, a lot of the baby stuff, like the crackers they make for Leo, are a weak sauce when it comes to calorie intake because they make them to dissolve. I'm like, that's kind of what people are. It's like the baby rice cakes.
It's so weak sauce. But imagine what they can do as they increase their fueling. The first thing I say to athletes that are struggling with GI issues is it's almost like this like self-perpetuating cycle.
Yeah.
Is because you have GI issues and aren't fueling enough, your body's not trained for it. And so it's like, you gotta practice.
Yeah.
And gotta fuel. And that practice is gonna like create this feed forward mechanism so that your body, and this is science driven, and we'll go into that science in a second, can handle it.
Yeah, and it's wild to think about just how trainable it is. So there's a 2017 study that found that just 2 weeks of exposure with carbohydrate sources improves gut performance massively. And that shows just how quickly these lines of gut cells turn over.
And unsurprisingly, that gut performance improved running performance.
Oh, by a ton.
Yeah. And so when we say gut performance, which I really like that term.
Yeah.
We're talking about like GI side effects and how they were feeling and
gastric emptying.
And gastric emptying and things along those lines, but also improved performance too. And I think marrying gut performance and running performance is cool to think about.
Yeah. And at this point it's really settled science as well. So in 2017 in sports medicine, there was this like seminal review study. And one of my favorite things in this study is they actually looked at people that did hot dog eating contests, like at Coney's Island, where they're eating like 60 hot dogs or whatever. And they train their stomachs in a way that is relevant for athletes, that essentially, as you do this, your perceptions of fullness, the way your stomach handles this can change to the point that athletes are able to consume these insane amounts. And when you think about how much we're slurping, it's not much volume. You can absolutely adapt to it. And as you do, the cell lines in the gut adapt, not just in terms of how they behave, like individually, but then subsequent cell lines, because those are epigenetic changes. And so it's so hopeful. So as you get do this, like, keep doing it. Don't just do it on long runs. Do it often on your shorter runs where you take a gel in. And you do that, you get better. And it's just like this self-perpetuating loop of getting better fueling, getting better performance, feeling better around training.
And do it in life too. Yeah. So often I feel like athletes that have had a history or struggle with current like disordered eating or eating disorders don't like the sensation of being full.
Yeah.
And practice like that being full is actually what's going to help you accelerate this process. So practice like being full with fewer meals, get those satisfaction bombs. And that might also feed into gut performance too, which is kind of great. It's like a burger and feeling a little full might be gut performance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very hard for some athletes. And definitely. So as I say that with like a note of lightness, I also recognize how hard that is for some athletes.
But the whole principle here, essentially, if we want to simplify food doping down to like really basics, is that the hotter the fire burns, the better you perform. And so keeping the fire burning hot during training is essential. We're not talking outside of training, it's also essential, but like in training specifically, that is when the fire is at risk of dimming the most. Because the body goes into self-preservation mode when you're under fueling substantially, where it decreases resting metabolic rate. So the things that these athletes are often pursuing of like, you know, I want to have better body composition, or I'm worried about, you know, eating too much or whatever. It's like, well, no, if you're consuming 300 calories per hour, your burn rate's actually going to get higher. You're not only going to perform better and be healthier, you're also going to address any concerns you have with things like metabolic rate. Like it's such a counterintuitive thing that often when people look in the mirror, they're seeing the opposite impact of the thing that they're looking for. And that's why it can be such a mindfuck. And we promise you, that's why we keep coming back to the science, like food doping is legit.
Yeah. Can I pose a question for us here?
Definitely.
So food doping, I think, is great, but I think there's also different environmental contexts in how much like calories and how much we put into the tank. Yeah. And there's a great study that came out in 2023 in the journal Temperature, which is a great temperature. And the title of the study is instructive by itself. The increase in core body temperature in response to exertional heat stress can predict exercise-induced GI distress.
Yeah.
So we know that in hotter environments, it is harder to get in like this amount of food. What do you tell athletes? How do we go about helping athletes fuel according to different conditions?
I think it's just part of the process. Like you get better at it. That's where liquid fueling really comes in handy.
Yeah.
You're going to be consuming more liquid. So have a ton of calories in your liquid. And you can almost always get up to the 300 number via that. And also just keep your core temp down. Like don't overexert.
Practice pre-cooling. Stay wet.
Yeah. But also at the same time, you adapt to that too. Like you get better at taking in fuel at any time. And eventually you can just essentially have an iron stomach. And problem is you need to work your way through it just like anything else. It's like, I think sometimes people expect with gut training that it's easy within the first few weeks. Whereas like we never expect that of training itself, of running training. Like you go out and run your first 5K ever. Of course it's going to be hard. Similarly, you take in your first 300 calories per hour on a long run. Of course it's going to be hard. And then later on, the 5K is just your warm up. Just like the 300 calories per hour is like nothing.
I love that point. It's all incremental training.
Incremental and stomach training. The big theory about food doping is that stomach training is the ultimate body training. Mm-hmm. So double down on it, focus on it, and it'll raise your ceiling to levels that you can't even foresee now.
Well, I'm all about the incremental slurping.
Incremental slurps?
Yeah, you gotta build those slurps.
Okay.
To the point where you're rapping. That's the culmination, is a rap.
I think that this is the perfect intro in talking about slurps, because I think this company is really into our slurp energy.
This company is totally slurp positive. We've been communicating with them, and I love them.
Okay, I'm obsessed with this company.
Yeah, the people and the company and everything they stand for and product.
The product, like literally, we wanted to introduce this to you because after a while, we're just like, all right, if we don't partner with this company, we're not living up to any of our principles because they are so fucking awesome. So who are we talking about, Megan?
Jonji.
Jonji, apparel company. We absolutely love them. You can on their website, 15% off using the code SWAP. Please go buy something on Jonji. It'll show that the podcast resonates with the people that also like Jonji. But the side note here, we're going to get to their products in just a sec, is they are dedicated to the environment. 2% of their sales are donated to clean water programs. And not only that, their products are guaranteed to last for 5 years.
Have they met David Roach? If you were part of their group and as they were deciding this, they'd be like, 5 months.
I'm testing it right now and they haven't broken down yet, which is pretty remarkable for me.
And you break everything down within like 5 days.
Yeah.
But a 5-year guarantee is pretty bonkers.
So I think what happens with me is because I don't wash my clothes very often.
Yeah.
If you looked at my clothes under a microscope, you'd see like a soccer stadium worth of like microorganisms mm-hmm. just cheering.
Yeah. That's why your immune system is so good.
Yeah. But they're like doing things to the fabric. Yeah. It doesn't even break down John G. clothes. So absolutely love them for running. Basically, we're going to, in future weeks, we'll talk about different products and things. We'll make it really fun.
Well, okay. This is where Verdant is coming in.
Yeah.
I got the Verdant green shorts. They're okay. the 3-inch multi shorts. And I am, they're like coming today. And yeah. I'm so excited because the color is just, it's exactly how I want my personality to like embed in like the world.
Yeah.
And I love the color. I love the vibes. And I've been like tracking the package furiously. It comes in 3 hours.
Okay. So Jonji, I think that term there is a really good one, is a vibe.
Oh, right? It's verdant.
It's a verdant vibe.
Yes. Yeah.
Of like uplifting, community oriented. Like they stand for what they believe in. And they also are just great people. Like the reason that we're partnering with them, like we tried to play hard to get. Like we were like.
And we don't ever do that.
No.
No, it just happened by, we were actually just a little behind in life. Yeah, and so we were playing hard to get by being busy. Yeah.
This might be too much. Maybe John G will end this partnership sooner rather than later. But I was like, this is teaching me bad lessons about negotiation. Yeah. Because like I'm usually like over the top kind and nice and stuff. And I just didn't respond to emails for a while. And John G's amazing people were like, hey, you should still like, we'll increase what we're going to offer. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Maybe I need to be an asshole this whole time. But go to Jonji, use code SWAP, SWAP for 15% off. We love the company and we love the people and you're going to love their products.
It's so fun. And let's get into sports stories
now. Okay, do you want to do sports stories? Or do you want to get to the performance studies?
Okay, we've done so much science. This is the first time in my life that I'm going to say, I think we need a little bit of a break from sexy science.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Too much.
Yeah. Okay. No, and it's not too much.
Yeah.
It's the right amount, but it'll be especially the right amount once we do these sports stories.
Okay. Slurping break.
Yes.
Just put down our slurps.
Prime the pump.
Get to sports. Okay. Actually, this is relevant to conversations we've had about mental health too. First is Marlon Reusser. She's a professional female cyclist. At the Tour de France Femmes, she won the time trial.
She's a like notorious time trialist. She's incredible.
Yeah. In emphatic fashion. But at the World Championships, which were just a week later, she dropped out during the time trial.
And not only did she drop out, everyone was like, oh, did she have a mechanical? Sometimes in cycling, when someone's having a rough day, they're like, they're having a mechanical in my legs, which describes some of my bikes. I totally know that feeling. But she was sitting on the side of a road crying and no mechanical in her legs, but I maybe a mechanical in her brain, which is very fair.
They often call it mental flats.
Yes. Yeah. She
had mental flats all the time.
Had a mental flat. And it happens to the best of us. And I thought it was a really great example because she was just on like the highest high at the Tour de France. And cycling is so hard because you're racing so often that it like, it takes so much out of the body. And I don't think we talk about mental flats enough.
Yeah. And I mean, Tadej Pogačar really dealt with that too, where he got passed in the time trial by Filippo Ganna, which, you know, for the best cyclist in the world, it's weird to get passed in a time trial.
Well, for context, in a time trial, you have a 90-second head start usually. Like that, yeah. So if you're getting passed, you're like falling behind.
Yeah. And I just think it points out that we need to pay attention to the mental side of this stuff so much. I mean, Marlon Reusser actually came back and raced really well at the time, the road race, but you know, even these superhumans have moments where they're just like, I don't know.
Well, we're all human. Yeah. Superhumans are, half of that word is human. And I don't know. I feel like as professional athletes, it doesn't get talked about enough for professional athletes, but I think also in the general context of training, it's hard.
Half of that word is human. That's poetic, Megan. Superhuman.
It's deep math.
That was so verdant in my soul. But it's a good point about like, you know, what we frame this. You are all superhumans out there.
Yes.
And I think sometimes people are like, I'm not like them because I'm different. Like I quit my treadmill workout or whatever. And it's like, no, that just brings us all closer together. And, you know, Marlon Reusser is insanely talented and tough and goes out there and does that stuff. Other people that might have a little bit different genetic context will end up in a different place than her, but it doesn't mean you're any less superhuman. So embrace the human element of the super.
Well, I feel like it gets expressed in different ways. Like I fully empathize with this because every once in a while, I'd say maybe like once every 4 months, I have a run where I'm crying on the side of the road.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it could be various things. Happens a lot on Magnolia Road here in Boulder. There's like specific spots. I'm like, I've had a solid cry there.
You know what I can't ask you though?
What?
Where are you at in your cycle? Your menstrual cycle?
Oh, yeah. In the moment, that question does not fly.
That's one thing I've actually
And then learned. The next day, I'm like, I feel validated. I got my period.
Yeah. And then you're like, guess what I have, David? And I'm like, no shit. As a coach, too, I've had to be very careful about that. I'm never like, so, you know, where? Or if I do, I'm like, I make sure I don't do it after a mental thing. I make sure I do it after, like, you know, to just get a feel. It's like, so where are you at in your cycle right now? Because, you know, that's relevant in the late luteal phase from some athletes in terms of performance. Not, hey, why are you crying in the bushes right now?
Yeah, but what I've realized actually is those, for whatever reason, my body rebounds really well after the crying in the bushes days.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what Marlon Reusser is saying. She came back and had a really great day. And I don't know for me whether it's like, that means that I've ended a run early and my body is like decompressing, or if it's this newfound mental fire that I have.
Yeah.
But I've often had really strong performances a day, 2 days, 3 days after those days where I have a mental flat.
Yeah. But I think that it might actually be related that
yes.
the mental flat.
Or I got my period and I'm I'm superhuman. Yeah.
Yeah. Super flow makes you extra superhuman. Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those moments where like, stepping back and understanding that athletics is a way to express humanity, not to cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think often people focus on us talking about airplane arms and not enough on us talking about crying in the bushes.
Like, yeah.
We want both, though we do obviously want to control the crying in the bushes over time so that you are uplifted maximally. Make sure you're feeling that too. Like the coolest thing about sports is that opportunity. Like I have cried more running about emotions, about positive emotions, negative emotions, everything, than I ever have in any other area. You know, it gets back to my masculinity discussion. Like, I think running is a place where, like, any of the toxic parts of masculinity kind of fade away. And I wear my short little shorts and shave my whole body and cry about, you know, the beauty of Leo's smile or whatever. And it gives me that, like, it breaks down those barriers that I might be putting up.
So. Okay, I'm going to have one comment, and then I would love to get back to the toxic masculinity discussion because we're doing it. We're weaving it in. When we like teed it up kind of in the outline, I got very excited. But I think for me, the appreciation of the airplane arms is so much higher after I've had those days crying in the bushes. Like for me, when I have those like mental flat days, when I come back and do it, the validation and the sweetness of that means so much more.
Yeah.
And I mean, I appreciate it so, so much.
And mental flats can last longer than a day.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
They can last months.
Months, years for some people.
And it's okay. Like, you know, you can fix that flat. And even though we say the word fix, it's also understanding that that's what makes you, and that's great as it is. Like there's no inherent value in athletics on its own.
When you use the analogy, fix a flat, I get really afraid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm horrible at fixing flats.
Yeah.
Like literally fixing flats.
That's like what therapy is. Therapy is me coming and fixing your flat for you. Therapy is the Uber that you call to drive you back to hell.
I'm like, help. As I was gravel biking this weekend, I was in the middle of nowhere, like biking through these overgrown fields. And I was like, fuck, I'm going to get a flat and miss my flight. I'm going to have no idea how to change the flat.
Yeah. Oh my
gosh. It was really irresponsible actually.
You were in Utah too, so it's going to be like that.
They probably don't do Ubers on Sundays.
Yeah. It's going to be like that book, Educated.
I was wild. We haven't talked about Educated in so long.
Yeah.
And as I was riding through these like overgrown meadows, I had Educated in my mind. And I don't remember much of Educated besides the fact that there was some violent scenes.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to get murdered out here. I literally thought of the book out there.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Granted, me just laughing like that at you saying you're going to get murdered would be very weird to people that don't understand our dynamic.
Yeah.
But trust me, it wasn't too creepy. Actually, Educated, great, great recommendation there.
It was a great book. We read it like 6 years ago, so I vaguely remember it, but I remember that it was incredible.
Yeah.
And I remember enough of the details that when I was biking in a random field in Utah, I was like, Educated.
Yeah. Good book.
Yeah.
So on the masculinity front, I actually don't have that much to say, but what I was reflecting on it, the reason I was reflecting on it, and maybe we should talk a little bit more about current events on the podcast in general.
Yes.
Because I love non-athletic things and we think about them and talk about them a lot, is right now, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, so the owner of X/Tesla and the owner of, you know, Meta /Facebook, are debating or talking about doing a fight.
Who do you think would win?
I think Musk would win. BC's like 6'3". Mark Zuckerberg's like strong and good at fighting, but like Musk is huge.
He's small. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big guy. But I mean, who do you think would win?
I would actually generally say
Asteroid. The asteroid should win. That is what absolutely should win.
Actually, the fight's not going to be happening because the world's going to be destroyed before we get to that point.
Yeah. If God forbid, you know, like, hopefully at this point, because the world is, you know.
World's tenuous.
Or this type of shit happens and people are like, not just immediately saying, this is dumb as fuck. What are you doing? You know, you two are supposed to be like these titans of industry and that are lifting up, you know, or at least young men are definitely looking up to you. Young people are looking up to you.
Well, I think a lot of those people are withering into the bushes.
What do you mean?
I mean, I don't think they're considered titans. I mean, they are, yes, they're titans of industry, but I feel like both of their reputation has gone to the point where like their supporters have migrated into crying in the bushes.
You know, maybe I think Zuckerberg's never really had too many fans, but Musk is just like solidifying his fan base in a certain way.
I mean, a very specific fan base.
But my point isn't about that. It's more about just the nature of like your petty grievances are being played out in a masculine, toxic, this toxic, gross fight type environment. It's like, why are you modeling this for anybody? Like, even if this is what you want to do, go do it on your own time and like go fuck yourselves. Like, because I'm thinking about this young boy, right, that we're raising. Mm-hmm. And clearly every parent has this reflection that like everything that that kid comes into is something that they're introduced to.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. There are certain things in the brain, but like without being introduced to things, we are just animals. We are no different than like any other creature. And so I'm like, once you start exposing people to this being like a valid way to disagree and to like publicly posture and stuff, you're just creating this environment where you're perpetuating violence as solutions to things.
And as a masculine trait. Is that where you're going? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of it because like this is clearly toxically masculine, but it's just toxic.
In general. Plain. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Without even gendering it.
And so, yeah, I mean, what I was thinking about with Leo is just like how much I want him to avoid like toxicity, because like that is a ever-present thing throughout human societal history where, you know, these men that are quote titans or leaders or whatever model a way to be a man that is violent, that is nasty, that is confrontational. And it's like, fuck that shit. You can be loving and open and kind and honest and cry. And that is the masculine thing I want to raise him in. And that was all because of dumb back and forth between Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg.
I love that. It was a great thought. But actually the other day I was having this reflection is when we were going through the pregnancy journey, I found out we were having a boy. And initially I was actually pretty upset. Like there was, I don't know, for whatever reason, there was this like part of my brain that wanted a girl so badly. But now that we have Leo, I'm like, thank gosh, like I love him so much. I love him to pieces for who he is. But I also think in society, there's this huge role to raise loving and kind men and boys, or however they identify. And I'm excited about that.
Yeah. And however they identify too.
Yes. Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, just, I don't know. I guess sitting, just being with Leo so much alone this week and seeing this essentially, you know, babies are innocent just by the nature of being a baby.
Yeah.
And you know, that
until he wants to eat my chocolate in the morning. Yes, I had chocolate oatmeal this morning, and he was like, "Mom, I gotta have that."
You see, I was
he was not innocent. He was like, "I want to be real violent with that chocolate oatmeal."
Yeah, I was feeding a lot of stuff when you're gone. But like, my reflection on that is just that, you know, one, that, but it also gives me a lot of compassion for everybody, like in the sense that a lot of the things that like people then impose on the world around them is because of things that the world imposed on them, and they're perpetuating these cycles. And what I was thinking is like, I need to understand where those cycles are in myself and break them by force. Because like, even as I say this, like I obviously have toxic traits too, you know, or like little things that I've absorbed. And like, I just decided that I really want to understand that and understand that world and read more about it just so that I can like be part of that change, not just in like what I think, but also in you know, how I'm raising this kid.
Were you exposed to that as a kid at all?
I mean, every kid. I played football.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I mean, I was in the locker rooms. Like, you know, when they talked about locker room talk in the 2016 elections, never have I been more furious with like when Trump was talking about grabbing by the F, you know, whatever. And it's like, that should be immediately disqualifying. And locker room talk used as an excuse by prominent figures that aren't Trump absolutely made me so fucking angry, because it's like, that is the problem.
Yeah. Well, did you feel uncomfortable in your skin as that was happening? Because I think it's really interesting to dive into, like, if you were exposed to something and it made you feel inherently uncomfortable as you were going through it, or inherently other, like, one, that what that does to a person, like, I think that's shaped you a lot. But what does that mean about, like, your core of a person? I think I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. Like, I'm not a good, like, I'm not good at, like, conforming in general.
No.
But what I ended up having to do in football was play a character, that was violent and wanted to harm people and things like that. And I think sports are great. Sports are a great place that is other than this, like it's separate, right? Than like the locker room part of it. Like the field is different than the locker room. Mm-hmm. And I never obviously participated in that stuff, but like, you know, at the same time, I'm just reflecting on how much this process is insidious and ever, you know, continues. And you see it now with like,
oh, and little things too.
And, but like every, like so many male role models are like this still. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong? Like, how have we not learned that this stuff is not what it takes to be strong? And also like is probably a sign of insecurity, not security. And in ways being small, like violence personally, but then also like insulting people or the way, you know, people interact with the world. So I don't know. That was random.
But. No, I love that point. Yeah. We need to actually, we have not talked about this like on a deeper level yet. No. Our dinner table tonight, we're going to be like pounding the food doping. And I'm going to ask you lots of questions. Yeah,
about more toxic masculinity. I want a lot more like ice cream masculinity.
Oh, I like that.
You know, just like rainbow sprinkle masculinity.
With a cherry on top.
Yes.
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. Actually, here's a little bit of a palate cleanser about sports. I'm on these PR email lists. I don't know if I told you this yet. So for some reason, my email goes out to these PR firms that I'll get emails of people asking to be on the podcast or like me to write an article on them.
How did that happen?
I don't know. Someone sold my email at some point. Yeah. But throughout the process, there is one type of email that I actually really do enjoy getting, which is from a PR firm that represents an adult website. So like a porn site.
Oh, I'm curious. Tell me more. Yes.
Okay. So the two that I remember most recently is the first was on Saquon Barkley. Uh-huh. He's the running back for the New York Giants. He's famous for being a very strong guy who has really strong quads. He squats like 800 pounds or something crazy like that. And what it said is he was doing a contract holdout at the time. It was before he signed his contract. And the PR email was like, this adult film company is willing to pay him $10 million to do cam videos of his quads.
Of just his quads?
Yeah, just his legs.
We're talking like, are there fixtures and attachments related to this?
I don't know. They didn't get into the fine print.
Yeah.
But then the next week, I got one about the Orioles announcers, so the Baltimore Orioles baseball team. Their announcer criticized the team, and he was suspended, which is like really weird, you know, Soviet Russia shit.
Yeah.
And the website said that they're going to pay him the rest of his annual salary to broadcast cam videos, to just announce them between couples, to like be the broadcaster on them. And I'm like, this is really interesting. I greatly appreciate that this exists, but I'm also very confused about, are these real offers? Because if so, we need to get that offer to do something to cash in, because they offer quite a lot of money.
It would definitely be your nose strip.
Yeah.
They would offer you $5 million for your nose strip, and your eyebrows that have been slooped.
Man, can we just go in there and slurp?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, shoot. Incremental slurping, actually. Yeah. We'd be slurp turning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think John G supports this type of conversation after what we talked about?
They probably do.
Yeah.
Actually, they're open people. I like them. There's like zero toxic masculinity at John G. They're like the coolest, kindest people. Actually, so much that I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They're so great. Okay. Do you want to get to the performance studies from cycling? I actually think we might be running out of time.
Sadly, we're running. We did not hit everything in the outline.
Okay. Well, we'll get
to actually, this time it's my fault.
Yeah.
I had lots of questions about the toxic masculinity piece and all these things. So I apologize. It's on me.
Well, also the toxic masculinity piece was so unthought out. I'm still working through it because, you know, I think raising a kid just makes you reflect a lot.
Well, I have questions for you about how it relates to gender and gender identity. And I think gender is a whole spectrum. And I'm fascinated about that and fascinated how like where you fall on that gender spectrum influences how you think about these things.
Definitely. I mean, basically, like, I don't want anyone to be bound by like societal pressures to be a certain way. Like, I don't want women to be like kind or whatever. Like, I don't want that to be, I want them to be.
Well, I want everyone to be kind.
What I'm saying is like, you know, like
kind and
docile.
Submissive. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Like, yeah, I want everyone, like no matter where you're at, to like fully embody yourself, but also just to, you know, drop that bullshit.
Okay. We have to stop talking about this now because we can't forget hot takes.
Oh yes. Hot takes. I forgot about those.
Yes.
Okay. First one. Toenails are God's vanity project, and we would all be better off without them.
Yeah, I kind of, your toenail right now is gross looking. I kind of agree. Like, I uplift everything on your body except for that toenail.
It's when I drop the crib on my toe, not from running.
Yes.
I actually feel like we both have pretty strong toenails because we don't lose them very often.
I'm almost never lost a toenail, but then you drop the crib, and then I stepped tragically on your toe like 4 days later, and it just shot blood all over the room.
But it healed it.
Yeah.
So I guess like it had, we shouldn't make that.
This is gross. This is like showing toenails. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
But on the subject of toenails, I'm like, it's kind of weird that we can just lose appendages and they have no impact on like performance or health or anything.
I mean, we're not losing appendages. That would be like losing the whole toe.
But like, why are they even there? Like evolutionarily, what are they there for? We can probably
actually, that's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a ChatGPT question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's like a vestigial like evolutionary process that isn't relevant anymore.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. Huh. I mean, sometimes I use my nails to do legit stuff, but I don't use my toenails.
Hot take turned into evolutionary anthropology take.
Very interesting.
Okay, next one. The little phrase on top of all the goo energy gels, 5 minutes before and every 45 minutes after, has perpetuated an entire mass of people to internalize that belief and severely underfuel. Five before and 45 after is not enough.
Yeah, that's actually a true statement. You actually read it wrong, though. It's 5 before every 45.
Five before exercise.
So 5 minutes before exercise, take a gel, and then 45 minutes, every 45 minutes subsequently, take a gel. But that's true. Yeah. And I think it actually reflects the idea that this goo slogan was created long before we thought about the performance science that we now know.
Yeah.
I mean, I really love goo as a company and everything that they do, but I agree.
Yeah. They need to be a little bit less thick for me.
Yeah. Goose. They're hard to slurp.
Yeah, I can't slurp my goose. That's really tough. That's why we love Precision.
Yeah.
On Precision Hydration, use offer code SWAP if you want 15% off. But yeah, no, I think it is really important. Basically, you should be fueling at least every 30 minutes on your runs over 75 minutes.
Yep.
No matter what. And, you know, leave this type of advice where it should be, which is in the trash can. Okay, last one. People that record every single walk, 0.2 mile by commute, breath, etc. on Strava are not cool. They actually said are the worst, but I was like, I don't like that, even as a hot take.
It was also are the worst in all caps.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're escalating it. You know, sometimes it is a lot of clutter.
It's not the worst though. It's not a bad thing. I would just say, like, remember that, like, how you influence people around you can be in ways big and small.
Yeah.
And so if you're using a social media app and being public on it, like, also make it a little bit interesting or fun or whatever, yeah. I think.
Actually, there's studies out there. Remember the study that was looking at, like, how people connected with their Strava followers and how that impacted their training and performance habits? So there's been actual legit scientific studies that have shown that.
Yeah, so I love when people upload everything, do whatever you want, but also have a little bit more fun with it. Also, viewing athletics a little bit more like, it can be good or bad, right? You can wear your heart on your sleeve, but also be silly or whatever. I think is kind of fun and it introduces a lightness to it that is interesting for others, but then also cooler for yourself.
Well, I'd be curious actually to look at, like, have different cohorts of Strava titles and understand how that relates to training consistency and performance. Like, and if the, like, more creative thought out titles actually, like, have, and it's probably related to intrinsic personality more than anything else, but I would love to do a study on that.
One thing I did hear is that emoji use corresponds most highly with the number of kudos a person gets.
Lack of emojis or increased
use of them.
So emojis, but they're probably being funny too.
Yeah. Well, and they're probably just more invested in it. But on, like, a more general idea, what I think about here is it'd kind of be like having a diary, right? And just in your diary being like, ate food or whatever. It's like, that's not the point of a diary. Like, open up, say something. At least tell us what you ate.
At least tell us it was tapas.
Yeah. Well, don't tell us that. I'm still down on tapas. Okay, on to listener corner. This is actually really relevant for this moment. I normally listen to you guys on runs or at the gym, mainly powerlifting. Lately, I've learned to pause the podcast when starting a heavy set. Some of the stuff you say gives the gym equivalent of a spit take or a groin pull, especially when getting close to your sign-off huzzah. Maybe a warning/disclaimer?
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about someone powerlifting and listening to us.
Yeah, power cleaning while listening to the SWAT podcast.
Ooh, I do. I do that sometimes when I edit.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's not really the podcast for, like, heavy lifts necessarily. I feel like the energy needs to be just a little bit more angry. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, bump up that masculinity just a touch.
Yeah, a little bit of toxicity does help for your max bench press. Like, I remember back when I was lifting really heavy, I would totally need to listen to, I remember this song, Headstrong by Trapped. It's like, back off, I will take you. I was like, that's exactly what I needed. And not to say the song is toxic, it's not. It's a great song.
That was a great interpretation of it.
Yeah, that's all I remember is because that's what I needed. And meanwhile, the podcast is a little bit of like, it's a little bit softer, I think.
In different intonations, in some weird intonations, like,
And then,
And then, slurp.
Okay, last listener corner here. Just something that made me smile today and thought you guys might really appreciate. Homosexuality was only decriminalized in Ireland in 1993. Divorce only legal since 1995. Gay marriage was made legal in 2015. And abortion in 2018.
And Elon Musk in 2026. Yeah. Just kidding.
So we haven't exactly been at the bleeding edge of human rights. So it made me smile when I got an email from an organizers of the Dublin Marathon saying they've added a non-binary category for runners and allowing those already signed up to correct their details. baby steps, but pretty cool nonetheless.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like races are really recognizing this. It's been great.
Yeah. And it gets back to our discussion about gender, you know?
Yeah.
And fully expressing your lived experience in the world, especially through athletics.
Yeah. Like, especially while running really fast.
Or really slow.
Yeah.
Or sitting on the couch.
Yes. Or slurping.
Slurp, you know, self-expression is by far the most important.
Oh, for sure.
You know another way to self-express? Give us 5 stars on wherever you listen to podcasts. Click follow. That's really helpful for the podcast. And remember, slurp so freaking hard.
Huzzah.
Huzzah.
Slurp, slurp, slurp.